fact. You know, they walked out of the deal. They have to come back to the deal. Iran doesn't even have to sit and talk to them. This is a unilateral thing that the U.S. has to do. You know,
Shermin Narwani, thank you so much for coming on and for your time. It's great speaking with you.
My pleasure, Richard.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
I think by now Israel knows that it can't do serious damage to Iran's nuclear program. The Israelis, they're used to being given a carte blanche and feeling emboldened by the Americans. Perhaps they wanted to see if they can still get away with that kind of behavior under Biden, right? The United States and Israel, they've adopted a strategy here where they're playing good cop and bad cop. You know, Biden pretends that he wants to re-enter the JCPOA. He acts like he's engaging in meaningful diplomacy. And yet he puts ridiculous obstacles in place, saying that Iran has to act first, or that only some sanctions will be lifted, and turning a blind eye to Israel's behavior, who, you know, goes behind the scenes and carries out terrorist attacks on Iran's soil and on its enrichment facilities. You know, through feigned diplomacy and violence, the United States and Israel are trying to squeeze Iran on both fronts and pressure them. And of course, this is not going to work because, as many others have pointed out, Iran did not tolerate 4 years of Trump just to appease Biden. Now, for a moment, there was a fear that the talks here in Vienna would cease. However, that did not happen. In the end, the JCPOA Joint Commission did reconvene, and it was decided ultimately that work would continue at the expert level. You see, Iran and the United States have not engaged in direct talks. Instead, what they've done is they've had a formation of two working groups, one based on how the United States would end up lifting sanctions on Iran, and how the other group would get Iran to return to the original limits stipulated within the JCPOA. Now, Iran's deputy foreign minister expressed frustration during the talks in Vienna at the lack of condemnation over Israel's actions. And of course, I'm not surprised, because the European powers basically said nothing. China condemned the attack, Russia expressed concern, Iran is calling it nuclear terrorism, which is what it is. But the European powers, of course, which always side with Israel and the United States, have basically said nothing.
These acts of sabotage and terror should have been condemned by European countries and E3. We are somehow satisfied with the positions taken by Russia and China. But in fact, the Europeans not only ignored this important act of terror or sabotage, but also they were busy to impose new sanctions on Iran.
When asked about this act of sabotage at Natanz, the White House spokesperson, Jen Psaki, not only denied any involvement, but any knowledge as well. Take a look.
I wanted to ask about the attack on Iran's Natanz nuclear facility. Is there concern within the White House that this will derail ongoing talks to reestablish the Iran nuclear deal? And has there been any effort by the administration to reach out through intermediaries or any other way to Tehran and make clear that the U.S. wasn't involved in these attacks, or in the attack?
Well, we of course have seen the reports of the incident at the Natanz enrichment facility. The U.S. was not involved in any manner. We have nothing to add on speculation about the causes or the impacts. I will say, on your first question, though, we are focused on the discussions that we expect to proceed this Wednesday in Vienna, to the diplomatic discussions that have been taking place and took place last week. We expect them to be difficult and long. We have not been given any indication about a change in participation for these discussions.
Further pointing towards Israel and American involvement, the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin just so happened to make a visit to the Israeli occupation right on the verge of the attack. Is that just a coincidence? I mean, the timing is definitely odd, to say the very least. Not only that, but Austin made no mention of the incident, which seems to indicate that the United States was likely in on it, or at best, turning a blind eye to Israel's behavior. The United States and Israel also collaborated on a forum recently established secretly during the Obama years in order to exchange information on Iran's nuclear program, and where Israel effectively dictates to the Americans what it would like to see in a potential agreement. What's interesting and, of course, very telling is seeing the various headlines in international press about the attacks at Natanz. Almost all of them say in the headline that Iran blames Israel. But if you look just underneath and you actually read the article, it says very clearly that Israeli media and radio are the ones who first reported the Mossad as being responsible. It's like with the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Even when we know and have confirmation that Israel is behind these killings, the media refuses to report honestly on them and helps to mask Israel's crimes. This is a great way to do propaganda. Not only are the media obfuscating Israel's role, as if it's unconfirmed or uncertain, but on top of it, they make it look like Iran is the aggressor and trying to unfairly blame Israel just for the sake of blaming Israel. You know, it's not without just cause that people's first instinct was to think that Israel was behind this attack at Natanz, right? Israel, in cooperation with the United States, has done this before. Just last year in July 2020, there was an explosion at the exact same nuclear facility in Natanz. This was confirmed to have been Israel. During an interview with Army Radio, Israel's former defense minister, Lieberman, expressed how he was annoyed at Cohen, the head of Israel's spy agency, the Mossad, for divulging details about that very attack to the New York Times. Now, prior to that, between 2010 and 2012, Israel proceeded to assassinate four Iranian nuclear scientists. Now, just a few months ago, in November 2020, again, we saw another Iranian nuclear scientist killed, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. In 2010, Israel and the United States worked on a joint project to sabotage Iran's nuclear program. The Mossad and the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, worked together to develop a computer virus named Stuxnet. This computer virus was used to sabotage centrifuges by making them spin at three times the rate and then break. The target, once again, the nuclear facility at Natanz. Given this recent history and Israel's track record and joint operations with the United States in attacking Iran and sabotaging its nuclear program, I have a very hard time believing that the United States was not involved and didn't know about this and didn't help in any capacity. Just the fact alone that the United States gives Israel $3.8 billion a year in military aid makes the United States complicit. But of course, their relationship extends far beyond just a yearly aid package. The Americans provide logistical support, intelligence, weapons, and have carried out numerous operations with the Israelis against Iran and their allies. It's unfortunate that despite years of diplomacy and goodwill on the part of Iran and other parties to the JCPOA, that the United States and its European allies never really held up their end of the deal. Perhaps out of all of this, there's still a silver lining. An experiment was held, and a lesson was learned, which is that the West can't really be trusted to engage in lasting and meaningful diplomacy. Because even when Iran fulfills its obligations and does its best, and it's verified by the IAEA, the United States still refuses to hold up its end of the deal and allows its strongest ally to carry out acts of terrorism to try and undermine diplomatic efforts and play dirty. The JCPOA was signed in October 2015. Trump pulled out in May 2018. It's now April 2021. Two administrations later, and the United States has spent more time outside the nuclear deal than in it. How can anyone look at that objectively and say that the United States is acting in good faith? What kind of message is that sending to Iran, to other countries, to the world? Israel knows that Iran cannot develop a nuclear weapon with the eyes of the world on it. Yeah, Iran has the capability in the mines, but with the IAEA 24/7 monitoring under the additional protocol, the JCPOA, and the whole world watching them, it's simply unfeasible. Israel wants to crush Iran's defense capabilities and won't be happy unless Washington makes a nuclear deal 2.0, which limits Iran's ballistic missile program as well as their support for Palestinian, Lebanese, Iraqi, and Syrian resistance, which of course Iran will never agree to. You know, Israel is the only actor in the Middle East with nuclear weapons. Israel has refused to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Israel has refused to sign the Chemical Weapons Convention. Israel has bombed and invaded every neighboring country, including Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Iraq. Israel has no 24/7 monitoring of its nuclear activities. There are no IAEA inspectors or safeguards there. Israel regularly allows itself to go and murder foreign scientists in Iran, to carry out acts of nuclear sabotage and nuclear terrorism. This is criminal. Can you imagine if Iran was killing Israeli scientists in broad daylight in Palestine or blowing up Israeli centrifuges? Can you imagine if Iran was sabotaging Israeli nuclear installations? Israel would declare war within the hour. The United States and all of NATO would join in. The international community and the United Nations would lose it. Yet somehow when Israel does it, everyone is silent. You know, the next time Netanyahu is talking about malign activities in the region and terrorism, he should go ahead and do his hair and makeup while he's at it, since he's speaking into a mirror anyway. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Over 250 international organizations are demanding urgent action from global governments to address the hunger and famine faced by hundreds of millions, a crisis the group said is driven largely by policy choices, including ignored appeals for a global ceasefire and humanitarian funding. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Andrea Germanis Ryder. This article is published under the heading, People are not starving, they are being starved. Over 250 groups demand rich nations provide urgent food assistance. Please stay tuned for the details. Over 250 international organizations are demanding urgent action from global governments to address the hunger and famine faced by hundreds of millions, a crisis, the group said, is driven largely by policy choices, including ignored appeals for global ceasefire and humanitarian funding. These people are not starving, they're being starved, the group wrote in an open letter released on Tuesday, April 20th. referencing the countries where they operate, including Yemen, Afghanistan, Ethiopia, South Sudan, Burkina Faso, DRC, Honduras, Venezuela, Nigeria, Haiti, CAR, Uganda, Zimbabwe, and Sudan, where they operate, the group said. These girls and boys, men and women, are being starved by conflict and violence, by inequality, by the impacts of climate change, by the loss of land, jobs, or prospects, by a fight against COVID-19 that has left them even further behind. The letter signed by the International Council of Voluntary Agencies, Oxfam International, Danish Refugee Council, and Save the Children was released a year after the World Food Programme, WFP, Executive Director David Peasley warned of the threat of multiple famines of biblical proportions. Despite that grave warning, the group said in a statement that so far this year donors have funded a mere 5% of the United Nations $7.8 billion food security appeal for 2021. Every day, we share stories and evidence of hunger, starvation, and increasing humanitarian needs. Yet this does not prompt urgent action or sufficient funding, they wrote. It is human action that are driving famine and hunger, the group said, and it is our actions that can stop the worst impacts. The letter asks the states to immediately provide $5.5 billion in food assistance to reach those who are a step away from famine. That amount, the group's statement noted, is the equivalent of less than 26 hours of the $1.9 trillion of countries spend each year on the military. Given conflict's role in driving hunger, global leaders must also work to end conflict and violence in all its forms, including by heeding UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres' call last year for global ceasefire so that humanitarian assistance can reach those in need. There is no place for famine and starvation in the 21st century, the open letter says. History will judge us all by the actions we take today. Oxfam International Executive Director Gabriela Butcher said there is no time to wait. The richest countries are slashing their food aid, even as millions of people go hungry. This is an extraordinary political failure, said Butcher, urging them to urgently reverse these decisions. And we must confront the fundamental drivers of starvation. Global hunger is not about lack of food, but a lack of equality, she added. Inger Ashing, CEO of Save the Children, issued a similarly scathing statement. We have warned donors over and over again their inaction is leading to death and despair among children, as we see in countries across the globe every single day, Ashing said. That thousands of children will be dying of hunger and disease in 2021 is a political choice, she added, unless governments radically choose to help save the lives of children. WFP warned last year that 270 million people were on the brink of starvation. Receiving the Nobel Peace Prize in December on behalf of the organization, WFP's Beasley said that the award was more than a thank you. It is a call to action.
Around the World with Reporters.
Despite the lockdown and curfew, thousands took the streets in Paris to protest against the reform of the social security system. The main reform concerns unemployed people who will receive less unemployment benefits. They will suffer an average loss of 20%, and some will even lose 45% of their unemployment compensation, meaning 300 euros less by month. Many will not be able to pay their rent. The demonstrators blame the French government for taking advantage of the COVID crisis to accelerate anti-popular measures.
Those who will be sanctioned by this reform are those who already suffer the most from the decrease in the work volume due to the COVID crisis. All the vulnerable workers who already lost their job and who are not financially supported by the government will become unemployed and will be affected by this reform. Yes, the government takes advantage of the crisis and pushes for unjust reforms.
Cultural workers made the demonstration very lively. They are paying a heavy price due to the outbreak of the COVID-19.
Today, people who work in the cultural sector often return to their parents and have no income anymore. Since more than 1 year, we don't work, we don't earn money, and the government does not propose any solution to us. Culture is part of the freedom of expression. Only the big shows financed by the state will survive, and the others will disappear.
Billions are given to big companies, 500 billion euros. At the same time, these companies fire workers. How is it possible that this government is making the shareholders richer instead of helping the population?
Indeed, the French stock exchange market has reached a very high level with more than 6,000 points. The 40 biggest French companies are doing very well since the COVID crisis, but the majority of the population does not benefit from this. More than 100 symbolic cultural places like the Odeon Theater are occupied since weeks, with protesters vowing to continue demonstrations until their demands are met. The COVID crisis will inevitably lead to loss of jobs for many workers. Also, if unemployment benefits are affected, these workers will be punished twice. Chris Denant, Paris.
Much of America breathed a sigh of relief when the cop who killed George Floyd was convicted of murder. A not guilty verdict was widely expected to have set off deadly rebellions on the scale of 1968 when Martin Luther King was assassinated, or 1992 when cops were acquitted in the Rodney King beating case. But across the country, there's a feeling that the calm won't last, because cops in America kill an average of 3 people per day. With police now often forced to wear body cameras and cell phones serving as citizen cameras, there seems to be a constant stream of shocking cop killings on the nightly news. North Carolina, Oklahoma, here in Chicago, and in too many other places to count, have all seen major protests against police violence in the past weeks. Storefronts are being boarded up, and many wonder if they will stay that way all summer.
I mean, if someone knocked out on election night and they woke up today and you told them everything that was happening, if they didn't really pay that much attention to politics, aside from like the media telling them that Trump is bad, they would say, oh, Trump's still in power. I feel like the cops throughout the country, even in Chicago, have become even more emboldened than last year.
The George Floyd protests in 2020 were highly politicized by the Democratic Party. But many wonder if the party will encourage the same confrontational stances in 2021. President Joe Biden reportedly discussed deploying the National Guard to all 50 states ahead of the Floyd verdict, while some Republican-led states are introducing often shocking anti-protest legislation.
The protest that we saw in 2020 was more of a prelude than anything, because now that all these facts are out there, now that, like, you know, there's a huge light shining on police violence and how this is connected to the state and how the state continually arms the police no matter what they do. Even if they've just murdered a 13-year-old kid, what is the state going to propose? More money to go to cops to train them, and that training goes to nothing.
The United States has become so divided that the threat of socioeconomic violence now occurs on a regular basis. Underpinning it all appears to be the widespread perception of a lack of justice caused by a fundamental corruption which appears almost impossible to remedy. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
¶¶ regime seems to be living in an unprecedented state of restlessness after a rocket reached what the Dimona mayor calls the most secure area in the world. Many observers consider the event as a clear intelligence and defense failure, whether the rocket was purposely aimed at the Dimona nuclear site or not.
There is much confusion among the Israelis. This unprecedented breach led the Israelis to question the capability and readiness of the Israeli home front and the capability of the military and political leadership. They are linking this event with other events in the region, mainly concerning Iran and Syria.
The military official statement changed its story on the explosion in an apparent confusion, first saying a Patriot rocket hit the Syrian rocket, while a later statement admitted that Israeli defenses failed to intercept it. Israel claims that SA-4, a long-range projectile handled by Syria's Russian-made S-200 missile system, had been fired at an Israeli aircraft to defend Syria from an Israeli attack, but had, quote, overflown its target and landed near the Dimona nuclear reactor. Israeli media have questioned the official clarification.
There are several questions that the Israeli army needs to ask itself. In the heart of this, there are continuous operations of the Israeli Air Force against Iranian targets in Syria. We have to say honestly, we began this. It began with the attack of the Air Force on Syria, and the Syrians always launch air defense rockets. The Israeli army's analysis is that if they wanted to target the Dimona reactor to retaliate for Natanz operation, they would have fired a more precise missile.
The missile incident came days after Iran warned that it will retaliate for a recent Israeli cyber attack against its Natanz nuclear facility. While the Israeli regime continuously targets Iran's nuclear facilities, it exclusively maintains a military nuclear program and arsenal with hundreds of nuclear warheads, which threaten the entire MENA region.
There is clear that the West is overlooking the Israeli nuclear program despite the fact that everyone knows that this secretive facility holds a military nuclear reactor for around 60 years now. They have an arsenal of tens of nuclear warheads. This nuclear threat is part of the Western hegemony over the region, and it was originally built by the West.
Analysts believe this event foreshadows a certain incapability of the Israeli military to protect its home front in the case of a war with the resistance, which could fire tens of rockets daily. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A fight for survival is what kidney failure patients in Yemen face as a result of the ongoing war and siege by the Saudi-led coalition. Many dialysis centers had to stop providing services due to a lack of fuel and necessary medical equipment. Therefore, the only dialysis center in Hodeidah in western Yemen struggles to cope with the large number of patients.
The center provides health services to approximately 470 patients per week, and the number is likely to increase as we receive patients from other cities, and this exceeds the capacity of our center. So we may have to decrease the number of sessions allocated to each patient. We also suffer from a shortage of medicines and medical equipment due to the continued Saudi blockade in our country.
Patients say lack of fuel worsens their suffering as they come from far areas twice a week and they can't afford the rising cost of transportation. Salim is one of them. He says he takes hours to get to the center due to the military confrontations on the main roads.
I live in an area half an hour away from the center, but the main road is closed due to the continuing military confrontations. So we have to take another road. It takes 2 hours. High fuel prices are also a major problem for us. We cannot afford the rising transportation costs.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015 to return the former president Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi to power. The brutal aggression has killed over 100,000 of civilians, most of them women and children. Hundreds of kidney failure patients may lose their lives if this center stops providing its services. However, as the people here say, the international community remains silent towards their sufferings. Abdul Latif Al-Washali from Hodeidah.
The weather has been improving in the EU as we edge closer to summer, but airports remain virtually empty and the bloc's tourism sector is on its knees. EU legislators say there is no coordination.
some member states asking 7 days of quarantine, some five, some requesting a type of test, some not, Greece taking away quarantine, and so on and so on and so on.
Conflicting vaccination strategies are adding to the confusion for citizens.
There are restrictions in various member states, and maybe in terms of age or gender, are some states not using AstraZeneca at all, and I fear that that may be reflected as well in the Johnson & Johnson availability.
The European Commission has set a target to see two-thirds of EU citizens vaccinated by the 1st of September, but things aren't going well.
Only 8% have both inoculations needed. What is being done to reach the 70% target in the next 4 months?
EU Health Commissioner Stella Kariakides prefers to talk about vaccines ordered rather than vaccines administered.
About 300 million doses of vaccines.
When signing new contracts with suppliers, EU lawmakers are calling for less secrecy.
Please also make sure that this time the contracts can be available. The Commission is always saying we want it, but we can't because of the companies. Make sure you're not bound by it in the next contract.
Slow vaccination rollout means new variants might emerge. Also, millions of businesses must remain closed.
The European Trade Union Confederation warns youth unemployment in the EU is set to rise by 70%, that's 7-0, unless drastic measures are taken by governments and institutions.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, is painting a gloomy picture.
The near-term economic outlook remains clouded by uncertainty about the resurgence of the pandemic and the rollout of vaccination campaigns.
In the EU, people out of work for more than 12 months are classified as long-term unemployed.
A crisis this deep has generated a huge number of long-term unemployed, and that may be a problem as the economy picks up.
Lawmakers and the European Central Bank are calling on EU leaders to speed up the delivery of financial support. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The funeral of 59-year-old woman, and only her close relatives are performing the last rites. Her family says she didn't die of the coronavirus, but due to lack of space in the hospital. The second wave of COVID-19 pandemic has brought the country's healthcare on the brink of collapse as hospitals struggle with lack of resources and space. The country is battling with lack of oxygen supplies and spaces to cremate the dead ones.
We are running out of space here. We have cremated around 40 bodies since morning. This is crisis. We are tired and overwhelmed.
Just a mile away from the crematorium, a truck loaded with oxygen cylinders is preparing a delivery to some nearby hospitals. With police protection, as oxygen tankers and cylinders are being looted in some parts of the country. This truck loader says we are working 24/7 to deliver as much as we can. So are the ambulance drivers.
This is war, not a pandemic. We are restless. We are running out of ambulances and oxygen supplies. But we are trying our best to save lives.
On Friday, India reported over 330,000 fresh cases of coronavirus, which is the highest daily increase the country has recorded so far. Over 2,200 deaths were also reported across the country, with the state of Maharashtra, Uttar Pradesh, New Delhi and Madhya Pradesh being the worst affected. The country has recorded 15 million cases so far and more than 184,000 deaths. Health experts say the unprecedented second wave could be blamed on a double mutant variant strains and recent religious gatherings and election campaigns, which has brought the healthcare to a breaking point.
India's coronavirus crisis is deepening further with each passing day. And the country is in a grip of a devastating second wave of the virus. Many unforeseen issues are cropping up and severely hampering the country's fight against the virus. Health experts believe the country's health system is on the verge of collapse, blaming the government's unpreparedness and failed policies for the country's failure to tackle the second wave. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
No one eats or drinks anything during the day.
Restaurants and bakeries are all closed. This is not neither because of threats or the COVID-19 pandemic. What has created such an atmosphere across Afghanistan comes from a religious belief that prohibits Muslims from drinking and eating under the name of fasting. Ramadan is the name for one of the holiest Islamic months and is the ninth month in the Islamic lunar calendar. The rising of the sun marks the beginning of fasting and Muslims are allowed to break it after sunset. Now let's see how Afghans break their fasts when the sun sets. The approval for every Muslim to break their fast is Azan-e-Maghrib, or the call for the sunset prayer. That is why almost all Muslims first do their sunset prayers before breaking their fast, which is called iftar. However, iftar time is a specific time for Afghans, as they traditionally and religiously get together at their homes or at restaurants. The gatherings are called iftari. There are special dishes and drinks in the Afghan food culture for iftari.
Iftar time is very important to our people. We prepare some special dishes and drinks for iftar, such as duk, tea, fresh juices, and some local dishes, including bolani, sambasa, ashak, manto, qabili, and kebab.
Many here also see the fasting month of Ramadan as a time for boosting their family relations and social ties by inviting others for iftari.
We have many traditions and customs to mark the holy month of Ramadan. For instance, most of us use Ramadan as an opportunity to invite others for iftari. This is based on our religious and traditional beliefs that, of course, strengthen our social ties.
In the meantime, there are also poor people who are in urgent need of food and shelter during the holy month of Ramadan. Our religion teachings urge Muslims to support them as part of duties of a fasting Muslim. Therefore, some individuals and charity groups set up food distribution programs for poor families during the holy month. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
COVID-1 vaccine was proved safe during the first phase of the human trials. And now the second stage suggests it also provides effective immunity against the coronavirus. Produced by the headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order, COVID-1 was injected to 280 volunteers in the second clinical stage. And the results were reported to the health ministry.
We passed the first and second clinical stages, and in the next 2 days, we will report the results of the second phase to the regulatory bodies. So far, we have achieved promising results as to the efficiency of the vaccine. Once this phase is complete, we can then speak with certainty about the exact percentage of the vaccine's efficiency.
Once the second phase is over and the vaccine is proved effective against the coronavirus, the third and final stage will then be initiated, which involves giving the jabs to 20,000 volunteers. COVID-1 authorities say they have already issued the call for voluntary injections since time is running short.
Based on international standards, if a vaccine gives at least 50% immunity against the virus, it is viable and can be mass-produced. We are confident from our lab tests that Coviran is effective and can generate significant number of antibodies, so we have already issued a call for volunteers to study its efficacy on a larger statistical population.
The first phase of the clinical trial was carried out in December last year, which proved that the vaccine is safe and will not cause any side effects. Other than Coviran, Iran is working on 7 other homegrown vaccines, including Covfars, which is now undergoing the first phase of the human trials. This as the country has already started vaccination of the most vulnerable groups, mainly using Russia's Sputnik V.
Coviran is already ahead in the race compared to other Iranian local vaccines. Now as the fourth wave of the pandemic is sweeping the country, Coviran developers say they're making their utmost efforts to get their jabs to the market within the next 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Signatories of the Iran nuclear deal end their fifth session in 2 weeks amid efforts to revive the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. 2 working groups have been formed, one to draft a list of measures that need to be taken by Iran, and another to outline the sanctions that have to be removed by the US. Now a third expert group will be working on the matter of sequence. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, said that would be the focus of talks when they resume next week.
Next week, the important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focused more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
Although no direct talks have taken place between Iran and the U.S., the American delegation has been engaged in discussions with the other parties, including Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China.
The top priority remains to focus on sanction lifting. In this particular context, the U.S. must lift all its sanctions, may it concern Iran or any third party, in thorough, complete, and straightforward manner.
Before leaving Vienna for Tehran, Araghchi said Iran does not want to prolong the negotiations, but also needs to take the time to work on every single word that's being drafted to come up with a specific formula allowing both Iran and the U.S. to come back to full compliance. Iran says the talks are on the right track and moving forward, but as the EU coordinator put it, there's still a lot of work to be done. Pomalinsky, Vienna.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. According to the Islamic narrations, the faithful have a lot of reciprocal rights, and many rewards will be given to those who observe these rights and try to help others. Interestingly, on the 12th of the blessed month of Ramadan, in the first year after Hijra, that is migration from Mecca to Medina, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, established the covenant of brotherhood between pairs of Muslims. Thus, Muslims became brothers two by two according to their thoughts and friendship. For instance, Salman became the brother of Abu Zar. Finally, the Prophet made Imam Ali his brother, as there was no one qualified to be his brother. The Prophet told Imam Ali, "You to me are like Aaron to Moses, except that there will be no prophet after me." Ibn Asir, famous Sunni scholar, writes in his book Asadul Qaba that the Prophet concluded the covenant of fraternity with Imam Ali two times, and each time he said to him, "You are my brother in the world and the hereafter." This act of the Prophet was very significant, as it showed how lofty and valuable Imam Ali's status was for the Prophet.
thick dust will nullify fasting, and there is no difference between ordinary dust and the powder of foods like wheat, flour, or even smoke. Of course, if the dust doesn't reach the throat, it will not nullify fasting. The steam of bathroom or sauna will not nullify fasting unless it is so thick that changes into water drops in the mouth. Smoking nullifies fasting. Using special sprays for inhalation will nullify fasting unless the person has to take it for his health. Oxygen capsule that is used for artificial respiration does not nullify fasting. But fumigation will nullify fasting if it causes thick vapor to enter the throat. As a reminder, for a couple of episodes, we have been presenting parts of Abu Hamza Thomali's supplication. We said that Abu Hamza was one of the companions of Imam Sajjad, the fourth infallible successor of the Prophet of Islam. Abu Hamza was from Kufa and his name was Sabit ibn Dinar Thomali. He lived a long life to see four Imams, namely Imam Sajjad, Imam Baqir, Imam Sadiq, and Imam Kazan, peace upon them. Imam Reza, peace upon him, said on him, Abu Hamza in his time was like Salman and Luqman in their time. It is noteworthy that Salman was one of the best Muslims and close companions of the Prophet of Islam, and Luqman was a sage in ancient times who was very pious and wise. After a short break, we will continue whispering Abu Hamza Somali's supplication. O God, engage us in your remembrance and keep us away from your wrath and save us from your punishment and give us sustenance from your bounties and grant us from your grace and grant us Hajj of your house and pilgrimage to the tomb of your Prophet. May your mercy, forgiveness and satisfaction be on him and his progeny. You are near to us and answer our prayers. Grant us to obey you and cause us to die while we are in your creed and sticking to your prophet's practice. O God, forgive me and my parents and have mercy on them as they raised me while I was a child. Return their good deeds with reward and their evil deeds with forgiveness. O God, forgive the faithful men and women, the living and the dead, and link between us and them with good deeds. O God, forgive our living and dead, our present and absent, our male and female, our children and adult, our free and slave. O God, bless Muhammad and progeny of Muhammad and inform me with good. My Master, I am the child that you raised, and the ignorant that you taught, and the stray that you guided, and the low that you exalted, and the fearful that you secured, and the hungry that you satiated, and the thirsty that you gave water to, and the naked that you clothed, and the poor that you enriched, and the unable that you empowered, and the humble that you dignified, and the sick that you cured, and the beggar that you spent to, and the sinner that you covered his sin, and the guilty that you pardoned. And I am the little that you amplified, and the weak that you helped, and the outcast that you gave refuge. I am the one who has dared unto his master. I am the one who has disobeyed the ruler of heaven. Yet you gave me respite with your forbearance and covered me with your cover as if you had neglected me and you kept me aloof from the consequences of my sins as if you had been ashamed of me. My God, when I disobeyed you, I didn't disobey as if I had been denying your lordship and belittling your command, but a flaw overcame me and my inner self deceived me, and your covering emboldened me. Now, whom should I connect if you disconnect me? Had I not been hopeful of your nobility and vast mercy, and had you not prevented me from losing hope, I would have been hopeless upon remembering my sins. O God, by the covenant of Islam, I take recourse to you, and by the respect of the Quran, trust in you. And through the love that I have for the unlettered prophet, I seek proximity with you. Therefore, don't make my reward the reward of one who has worshipped other than you.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
So we were just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted.
So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people think, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a PIT permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit, with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation.
I'm really glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Probably. Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout. But
get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
We
have
No, so I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful with it tied, like, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like the whatever size their shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children because this is something that can't be argued. Like,
exactly.
Even you can play devil's advocate, these are children.
Exactly.
Children are harmless, so...
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that this is something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing, and he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the witnesses who's basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together in the code of silence and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters. Police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working peoples of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
State of emergency has been declared in the U.S. city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday,
There's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But, I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from